they automatically name. Don't worry, I'll make sure when it's on the internet they know it's all right, the cast.
So we're gonna start a couple of just quick things. So first of all, we've been doing this now for what? I think this is like probably our 6th or 7th.
Yeah.
In like the last 10 years or something. So it's always a real honor to have Rabbi Einhorn, somebody who I grew up with my whole life. And it's funny because every single year I come with, you know, some stuff prepared because I'm always expecting him, like, all right, Mike, give it Bar Torah over here. You know, it's exciting. Get up there. He's always been encouraging me to do stuff. And the funniest part was I got a call from him last week, and he was just so excited about this. He was really, and he says, Mike, this is the year. And here I am. I'm thinking, all right. He's going to call on me. I'm really, really excited about this. And he goes, this is it. This is what it all comes down to. Are you ready? I said, absolutely. He goes, great. Call Elon Gold and tell him that we need a Dvar Torah from him. Okay? Not cool. I'm just saying I'm hurt, but, you know, it's fine. Hillel Education and obviously doesn't agree well with you, but we love you. And so we want to call on Elon Gold to have a great introduction to our Torah.
Just
and then,
an introduction.
Just an introduction. No comedy, yeah. Please.
It's so odd to not be the headliner. For me to not be the star of the show.
Oh, that's what Mikey
for
does.
For me to be the opening act, only for Rabbi Einhorn would I do that. And be the opening act. I'm a headliner. Anyway. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael. Thank you for letting me introduce you.
No, it wasn't introducing me. It was introducing.
No, I'm just, I am introducing the Haggadah. And by the way, for some of you who actually are expecting a comedy show here, first of all, I don't work liquor stores. Okay? You want to see me at the Laugh Factory? You come see me at the Laugh Factory. You're not going to see me at the Cask doing comedy. But when Michael called, and you know Michael, he's such a good guy. He has a good heart. Right? Oh, you're going to like this. Uretsky, this is a good joke I thought of as I was driving here. Where's Michael? Stay here for this joke. It's about you. Because every now and then he does really great things for the community. I've done things for him at the Savant Theater for charities, and he does this every year. And I love coming here just as a guest, and because he has a good heart. That's the true thing about Michael. He has a good heart. His liver is shot, but what a heart! The liver is fully diseased, folks. We've done tests. Anyway, he works here. You can't. He runs this place. How good could his liver be?
Exactly.
And he loves to sort of test out the products. You know what I mean? It's a good thing he doesn't own a brothel. Anyway, here's the point. Thank you, Rep. That was for you.
I was trying to get the point.
Oh, sorry. Are we live? Are we live?
Torah anytime, I have no chance of ever getting on. Torah never. Torah never, I'll get on there.
You no, asked no. You asked for this. You got it. No, they're brothels in the Torah.
It's not afraid of discussing it.
Not afraid of brothels.
Not afraid of brothels.
Not afraid of
it. No.
Anyway, so then I was like, well, what am I going to talk about? I'm an idiot. And now I'm reading this book, and I'm so excited. Because, like I said, I come here every year, and I'm so excited to hear what you have to share. But just as an intro to everything that you're about to share with us, this book by Mark Gerson, who is the guy who started Hatzalah, United Hatzalah, with Eli Beer. And genius guy. And it's called The Telling, How Judaism's Essential Book, besides the book, talking about the Haggadah, reveals the meaning of life. Which is amazing that the meaning of life, which we all know is in the Torah, it's also just in this little Haggadah. So then I started reading it, and I'm an avid reader. I'm already up to page 28. And again, because I have no wisdom to share with you, I will just sort of read just a few That's quick right. nuggets of what he's sharing with us. And it's about the telling, and the telling that we all are about to do 2 weeks from tonight, I believe. And the essence of the Seders, as we all know, are telling to our children, right? The Seder is not about us, it's about our children. You know, the entire holiday is almost framed to be for our children and to get our children excited and connected. But what I didn't know is that history was not kind to children and didn't give a darn about kids until Moshe Rabbeinu came along and awoken this world to, no, children are everything. And the stuff that I'm reading is fascinating. So just here's a few things. So the question, how could Moses fulfill God's command to keep the memory of the Exodus going forever? The memory of the Exodus and its future significance, the existence of the Jewish people, even the survival of our God in history, would depend on his answer. And here was the key. When Moses was still negotiating with Paro to free the Jews in Exodus 10:9, he said something subtle. We leave with our young and with our old. But with our young would come first, because that is the priority. No offense to the 70 and older here. The young is everything. And this might be the most radical and important idea in the history of the world. Beautiful. The world. And then he starts listing about all these countries and in China, how there was filicide, the sacrificial killing of children. He said, to this day, they're still uncovering mass graves of children where people just slaughtered children. They had just had no regard, let alone prioritize them. And it was prevalent in Greek and Roman mythology. And then he goes on to say this prioritization of adults in perhaps every other culture would continue without apology or explanation for thousands of years. And then there is Moses, who commands his people to orient their religion and their philosophy, indeed their lives, around the primacy and centrality of children. It's unbelievable. And, you know, to this day, here, let me just read instead of putting in my own stupid words. The idea that children should come first was a radical innovation that became a standard feature of Jewish life and then global culture. Right? And here's the last thing I'll read. He reveals the characteristic in Exodus 12:6. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them, when your children ask you, not if your children ask or should your children, it's that maybe they might ask you. No, they are going to ask you. And when they do, it says, in a world whose most sophisticated cultures would for thousands of years consider children as something to be merely tolerated or effectively denied, Moses had identified the asset he would work with to make the Exodus remembered as an eternal decree. He had identified an asset more dependable than buildings and more durable than history. Children, and specifically their curiosity. And the last thing is, and I love this, is, it is trite nowadays. Like, everything I'm saying now is also trite, to speak of this centrality of children and the importance of education to us now. To us, it feels trite. You know, their songs, I believe the children are our future. It's almost overdone now. But again, for thousands of years, this was not the case. And trite to speak of the centrality of children, the importance of education, that does not mean that such proclamations are natural, normal, or inevitable. It just demonstrates how successful Moses' idea was. And when I think about, I have four kids, so when I think about what I have to do, and that's why I show up every year, and I'm about to sit down and just take notes and listen, because sharing these insights to your children is more important than sharing them with our spouses or with our own minds. It's all about what we're hearing today to recount to our children. And everything about Pesach, why do you think we do the bedikah? Do you think God cares that we're searching for bread that we just put there 2 minutes ago? Do we do it for ourselves? We do it to engage.
Children ask.
It's the children. It's literally a Jewish hide and seek. And the moment we do that, that kicks off this holiday that involves our children, which is the center of my universe and should be the center of all your seders. Take it away, Rabbi Einhorn.
Thank you. That was an excellent beginning. First of all, Mike, thank you so much for hosting us each year. And a beautiful Akdama for a beautiful place, the cask, which is there at everybody's simcha whenever they need. And Mikey really represents the heart and soul of spirits. We say spirits, right? But Mikey is really spirit. He's a person with a great neshama. And there's no one who sees Mike and doesn't smile when they see you. So really, thank you for hosting this. I didn't ask you to give a Dvar Torah tonight because I asked you to say the entire shir. Mike, you got it. I want to thank you, Ilan. It's a beautiful message. By the way, it got like quiet for a minute. Oh, I mentioned the brothel. There are multiple parallels to Yetzias Mitzrayim being, that of discussing of Beis Nus, of the connection between the two. First of all, we talk about a Mitzrayim that Moshe had a tough time. Al ishke mishpe hoseihem, issues related to these kinds of topics, family matters, when he didn't want their tents mechuvanim, didn't want their tents parallel to each other. That was one. But the most famous connection I can think of is, of course, that the first person they're going to encounter as the person who right? Everything goes after the beginning. Hakol lechacha rosh. Who's the first person they encounter when they go into Israel? Who's the first one to shalom aleichem? It's Rachav, the Zona. Rachav's the first. That's the first. Of all the people to greet them, bring me the mayor, bring me this. You bring me Rachav? Not only that, she marries Yoshua. And she marries Joshua. And of course, so that idea, while we were talking humorously, of course, there's no joke without some truth to it, certainly tonight. So Yashar Koach, and certainly the idea of children is a significant theme as well. There's a lot you could do nowadays, also with AI. I'm going to sprinkle in a little bit here there, just so you could incorporate in your Siddharim how to, again, it's for the children. If this was about some other, I guess it's something for people who are learning Kabbalah for 40 years, I wouldn't do this. But this is supposed to be for the children. So if there's anybody who's supposed to incorporate creativity on any level, this is the time that you do it. This is when you break that out. We can't put instruments in Shul on Shabbos. So you might as well think of something creative and different now. So I just to show you, even on a visual level, a visual sphere, what you could do with Pesach night, or have your kids, even more powerful. We're not all going to sit there pairing visual spheres for our kids here. But let's be real. But however, you could ask them to create some unique and different prompt. I saw an older edition of Alice in Wonderland, and I was sitting there looking at it, and I'm thinking, what if I put the prompt in Alice herself going over to Paro? Moshe couldn't go. Alice went over there. So this is the prompt, Alice in Paro Land. And then while I was having fun, I did one more. I said, why not? Keep it going. I put in Alice in Kugel Land. And this is what we got over here. Okay, we got Alice in Kugel Land. All right. I don't know why not. But so the point is, you can give each of the children prompts and say, this is your prompt. Come up with something from your own life, merge it with Karpas, and give me the visual that you see. You're going to explain it at the Seder. Okay, that's one idea. We'll sprinkle them in as we get to them. So the idea is, this is a very different year. I'll tell you why. Number one, it's earlier. We scheduled it earlier. Mike has a big shipment going out to Arizona, whatever it is. We got to get the store ready. No, we did it earlier than we do it last second. And what that means is the new Haggadahs didn't come in yet in the mail. So it's even better, because what happens is I try to rush the Haggadahs to get some nice ideas in the previous year, but I never get to the Haggadahs before Pesach. I only get to them by the end of Pesach. So what happens to those ideas that they usually float into the ether? So what you're getting is the review of the Haggadahs, but also stuff during the year. I'll tell you how late the stuff came in. This just came in an hour ago in Amazon. This is delivered at Amazon. This is Rabbi Willig's Haggadah Shel Pesach. Rabbi Willig, one of the YU Rosh Yeshivas. You can get it on Amazon. And I quickly called his son, Rabbi Kiva Willig. I said, we got the shir in 4 minutes. Pick one page in here. Give me something. Your father, you heard the dinger, the checkout. He's at the checkout line at a supermarket. And we're like, give me one page. Are you serious? Yeah, one page. Give me one thing. So he goes, my father's mashalim were the best. We grew up on my father's, analogies that he would say at the Seder. So I go, which one you want me to do? He goes, do the one on Halach Ma'anya. I go to Halach Ma'anya. I hate to break it to Akiva Willig. His father didn't put any of the mashalim in Halach Ma'anya in the Haggadah. He's going to be upset. What I did find when I got there was Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayuav Oseinu. At the beginning, our forefathers they were worshipped idolatry. Okay? There's a whole machlokas when the Haggadah is the beginning. Where do you start the Haggadah from? The Gemara in Pesachim 116a says that Shmuel says you begin with Avadim Hayinu. Because our enslavement, that leads to the redemption. Rav begins with the story of Terach. Right? Terach's idolatry. Why begin with that? What's the Shaychus? So the famous answer of the Nesivas. The Nesivas says, based on the following mashal. Well, who's the real? Who's? No? Oh, I thought he said Nesivas. I thought he said relative. All right. Well, I can't. So when I take my glasses off, I can't hear. So I just make things up. You know? Okay. So the Nesivas says that there's a very interesting answer based on the following mushals. He said, my father's mushals animated our siddur. A robber slaps his victim and draws blood. The robber then proceeds to carefully bandage the wound and escort the victim safely to home. Must the victim say thank you? A similar problem raised on Pesach. Yeah, Hashem miraculously saved us from Egypt and escorted us to Israel. But that's only because he caused us to go into Egypt in the first place. Why do we have to say thank you? So I'll give you a Willie's answer. The answer to this question can be traced to Terach. Because of our impurities, Hashem had to cleanse us before giving us his three great gifts, Torah, Israel, Olam Haba. The purification achieved through Yisurim, a pain that was understood as two separate commandments by two different audiences. First, Hashem commanded Moshe and Aaron to determine when the Jewish month begins. The month that we left Egypt is the first of the month. In addition, Hashem commanded all of Am Yisrael to count the months of the year, beginning from Nisan, as a remembrance to the Exodus. The word Lachem refers initially to Moshe and Aaron, only later to every Jew. This duality reflects a critical dimension of our Avodas Hashem. You're required to determine the best of your ability what you particularly need to do. One who's not a member of a Beis Din is not in that original Lachem. He can't determine when the Jewish month is, but he's in the second Lachem, that which you need to do. So Egypt represents two emergences. There's the particular emergence of what took place, but there's also a collective emergence or a national emergence or what's happening to our people. This is a very relevant to our Torah. It sounds like, where are you going with Terach? No. Now at the Seder itself, we're on our consciousness is multiple layers of emergence and freedom and redemption. It's personal, what anybody is dealing with, what everybody struggles with. But it's also our people as a nation, which the generations that were people that were born from 76, 77 and up, really, fortunately, did not have a chance to encounter yet or to deal with on this level until the tragedy that took place this year. So you're going to have to frame the Seder probably a little differently than usual this year. But you cannot, you know, you obviously are not expected to bring it into a Tisha B'Av, but it needs some type of different framing. One of the Haggadahs I just loved last year was Rav Lopian. Rav Lopian is one of the great fathers of Musar. But his Musar was unique. It wasn't the hellfire Musar. It was through his personality. It was his character traits. There's a famous picture of him feeding a cat that just used to pass by the yeshiva, which was, you know, symbolic of just his sensitivity. So it was the Haggadah that was put together by his students. It's a beautiful piece. They say, remember once Erev Pesach, our grandfather, Rav Lopian, turned to our mother and asked, can he help with something to prepare for Pesach? His mother, she said to him, there's no need. His daughter, right? The mother, the one writing. There's no need. And she added, with a smile, that the only thing she needs is somebody should take the kids here. There's little kids, they're running around. Can somebody take the kids? Saba lo hiseis. Grandpa didn't ignore those words. He took them as though they were meant for him. We turned around and we saw he was on the floor playing with the children and doing cars with them with different things moving around for the children. Saba, this is grandfather. Revelia Lopian, the grandson of the husband. This is at least a 70-year-old Gadol B'Yisrael, at least, who was on the floor playing Erev Pesach. And the message is playing for Pesach is not just all the purchases you're going to make. It's not the Haggadahs you're going to buy. It's not even necessarily any spiritual work that you might do. But for Rav Lopian, the preparing for Pesach was to do what it takes to make the Seder manageable as the best that he could for the members of his family. That's what I thought. It was a beautiful idea from Rav Lopian. Great Haggadah. This gets people bothered a little bit every year. It's not our usual mainstream Orthodox Haggadah. But it's Dennis Prager Haggadah. excellent Haggadah. I'm telling you now, it's a great Haggadah. I dog-eared so much last year. Remember, at the end of Pesach, the whole thing was folded. Page 65. This is great. First of all, there's great questions for discussion. Would you rather your children be secular or even non-believers and attend Harvard, or be religiously committed and attend a non-prestigious university? What would you rather for them? Okay, again, you know, if you know Dennis, you know where he's going. He hates you. You know, he hates the Ivy Leagues, but if you understand where he's going. Now, that's not what I want to show you. So the Torah repeatedly makes clear that the worship of God means following God's dictates. Obeying God's command is what worshiping God, right? When the Russia starts casting, I don't like the commandments. I'm spiritual. You'll get people saying, I'm spiritual, but I don't like all these laws. Okay? So vast number of people within and outside of religion say they believe in God. But if belief means living according to God's moral dictates, how many people actually believe? Right? It's lumdus. If the definition was mean to have emunah, you can't command on faith. Either it's Reb Chaim Brisker he's saying. You can't command on faith. Either you have faith or you don't. Believe. Either I do or I don't. So the commandment is to do the actions which draw in faith. Those are the. So Dennis Prager's saying, how could you say you believe in God if you're not doing the things he's asking? So he says, this question was answered powerfully by a prominent contemporary thinker, Jordan Peterson. So listen to this. He says, who would have the audacity to claim they believed in God? If they examined the way they lived, would they dare say that? That's a heavy... Yeah, when you are a maimon in Hashem, you have a munah gashbarku, there's accountability. If you really believe, you would take stock. You would say, what am I doing then towards that? If you believe, it's what you call it in lumdus, it's a mechayev. It generates a certain responsibility. There are many nuggets, you get discussion points. I'm recommending this as one of the recommended haggadahs. The most underrated haggadah of last year, it got swallowed up by the lel of haggadah. The lel of haggadah was the hottest thing since Ilan. Everybody wanted the lel of haggadah, right? You never met a Jew who said, the lel of haggadah was okay. So, but at the same time, came out the Ger dynasty Haggadah. It's so good. Every page is good. Every page is great. So I'll share with you. Maybe we'll get to a couple. See how much time we have tonight with it. So first of all, Dayenu. It would have been enough. Says the Pnei Menachem, one of the Ger Rebbe's. The words seem beautiful, but what do they mean? None of it would have been enough. Har Sinai without the Torah. Everybody knows the perfume store mashal. Okay. Receive the Torah without being given Eretz Yisrael. What's the point of listing these? It's all a fantasy. It's not a real thing here. What is this Dayenu? So he quotes the Sfas Emes, the grandfather. He says, if you look carefully by Yaakov Avinu, by Jacob, it says, Yesh li kol, I have everything I need. Esav says, Yesh li rav, I have much. Sounds similar, right? The two of them. Yaakov and Esav. Yeshli Kol, I have everything. Yeshli Rav, I have so much. Well, Esav seems to be expressing Akaras HaTov. He was doing the opposite. A tzaddik knows that whether or not the bracha is apparent and obvious, he was given precisely that which he needs to fulfill his mission. What I got is what I needed. Yaakov Avinu knew that he was missing nothing at all. He had everything he could need. Esav saw the world differently. And wealthy as he may have been, he saw only that which he had not yet attained. He had a lot. I have much, but I don't have everything. When we say Dayenu, it's enough. We're saying if God had said we're stopping here, then we would have said that would have been sufficed. If the journey would have stopped at point A, then if that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted for us, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted for us. That's Dayenu. It's a tremendous testament of faith. I was at a bris today. So I was asking people around if they have stuff on the Seder. That's where you also get good stuff. Canvas. Where you, what do you call it? Canvassing? Canvassing, the social canvassing. So the one guy there said the following. He said, it's a very Litvish Dvar Torah, I'm going to tell you. What he means is, and it's a misuse of the word Litvish. It's sort of Lopion's Litvish. That was a beautiful piece. Litvish is taken to mean derogatory. That it's going to be a negative Tisha B'Av-like sentiment. So why do we have halach ma'anya, come invite a person, who all are hungry, come and eat, right? All are hungry, come and eat. So the answer is because we're supposed to know that by Korban Pesach, you can't include anybody if they're not in the guest list, if they're not invited ahead of time, right? You can't include them in the guest list afterwards. It's too late. You have to alaminoi. Once you make the Korban Pesach, it's over. You can't bring them in to eat on it. So we have it now, but know that in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, you're not going to be able to bring them in. So have the guests now, but you're not going to be able to have them later. He was so happy. He told me this Dvar Torah, Litvish Dvar Torah. It's a depressing Dvar Torah. I don't know who says it. So I said, but I stopped for a minute. I'm there. Now let's make it a Hasidish Dvar Torah. We're turning to HaKadosh Baruch and we say, we know the Torah says that you don't appoint people onto the invite list. But God, nail me on this one. I'm going to put people into our list. I'm going to invite them into our home nonetheless. Nitzchuni Banai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, are you going to be more makbid on that din? Of all the dinim in the world, you're going to be makbid not to invite people? Suddenly now you're machmir? What about everywhere else? Avodah Zorah, Mitchil Ovdei Avodah Zorah, Seinu. What about, here we show HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're right. So we're going to have guests. We're not afraid to keep including them. Right? I don't know if it's true at all what I said, but if you need a Hasidic spin and want to end with the Litvish one, that's it. It's Hasidish, very Hasidish. I admit that. But that's the sentiment of Nitzchuni Banai. My children, you know, whatever. I'll leave it be. You know what to do with it. Next. So you have here the showdown of Paro versus Moshe. New book came out by Koren. Great book. Great book. Called Questioning Belief. The author is Dr. Ralph Zaru. Dr. Ralph Zaru is the head of the, you know, where was Rabbi Jonathan Sachs the head before in the country? The Commonwealth. He was the Queen's College. Jews College. Good name. Jews College he was the head of. So the head of it after, two people after him was Dr. Ralph Zaru. And he's a, you know, he's a major academic. He's a, you know, astrophysicist, among other things. And in this book, he talks about a lot of interesting stuff. But he wants to talk about the difference between a Paro and a Moshe. And he says the following. He says, we know that Moshe is the embodiment of good. It's fitting then, if he's the embodiment of good, that Paro is the embodiment of that which is the opposite, Ra. And in a delightful cross-lingual wordplay, he is. The prevalent opinion of Egyptologists is that the Pharaoh of the Exodus was Ramses II. The Hebrew name for the settlement area of Israelites in Egypt, mentioned time and time again, is Ramses. Ramses means born of Ra. Ra being the great sun god at the center of the ancient Egyptian worship. But in Hebrew, Ra is Ra, evil itself. Paro even highlights, by the way, that relationship, that association. Before the last plagues, he warns Moshe. He goes, look out for the Ra. It's before you. Rashi says that there's a star named Ra, evil. So Paro says to Moshe, using astrology, I see the star rising towards you in the Midbar, where you want to go. And it's an emblem of blood and slaughter. And that's the way it was for the Jews were leaving east. But sometimes the sun gets eclipsed. What can you do? Sometimes Ra can't win the day. And that's ultimately what happened over here. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you would have had a win, Paro. You would have had a win. But Moshe is the epitome and the definition of Tov. He is the epitome of goodness, of humility. He's the exemplar of it. And he even says, I don't like to see things in black and white. But the Torah is telling you that sometimes you do need to see things as black and white. Sometimes bad is really bad. And there's no two ways about it. And good is good. And you have to call those out and recognize them and notice what they are. Share with you another idea. Rav Moshe Shapiro. Moshe Shapiro, one of the great Balei Machshava, passed away 2 years ago. So he raises, two key questions about the plagues. There's a lot of great stuff coming out by Moshe Shapiro. I recommend for everybody here the biography of Moshe Shapiro by, thank you, recommendation, Rabbi Nissel, Rabbi Menachem Nissel, wrote the biography of Rav Moshe Shapiro. It's incredible. Now, he says, what's the deeper meaning of the purposes of the plagues? That's number one. Are they just revenge or is there deeper significance? And number two, what does it teach us about the world? What do I learn now? I understand what God did then. Fine. I'm in charge. What does it tell us now? He says something beautiful. He says, Paro sought to thwart God's blessing in the world. And the growth, the prosperity that Bnei Yisrael wanted to bring. They genuinely come to Egypt and they were helping grow the society. That's why he wouldn't let them leave. He needed them. And Paro's hatred of the Jew was so strong that he was willing to dismantle his entire country, dismantle his entire nation. He says, it's not just by chance. A totalitarian leader, the very chaos that they bring into the world by destroying anything from flourishing, ends up upending nature itself. And this is evidenced in many places. Wherever you have a leadership that operates at such a level where they determine what's order and they run it their way and no one else has a chance to flourish, nature itself gets upended. I mean, I can't think of a clear example than under communist Russia with the nuclear reactor. That nature finds its way to rebel against you, whether externally or internally, because you can't control the chaos your way. It never works. And that's where Moshe Shapiro says with Paro and the Makos. Paro and Makos.
Same with Hamas.
Say out, meaning their way. By the way, you look at the shots they keep showing you of the areas of devastation. And it's phenomenal to see that if you look at some of the areas prior to the devastation, yeah, some of the images are far off. But a lot of the areas are not far off. A lot of the areas are not far from it. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that in Israel, we'll have no luck growing the land. Nobody will be able to grow the land. And the Rashi on Sanhedrin says there is no greater sign that the end is near than when the people return to the land, because only they will have the key to unlock the ground from growing. A place that was desolate and void, right? The Mark Twain quote, they don't need to quote again. Just as this place is a shmata, who needs this place? But to understand, once the Jews are there, it begins to grow. And that's part of the skula of the land itself. Next idea I wanted to share with you. Next idea. Another one of the great Haggadahs that came out here, but it's not translated. And it's hard to get through. But it's excellent. It was definitely, I'm putting it in the top five of the last 3 years. Rav Shaul Alter's Haggadah. Rav Shaul Alter, the Ger Rosh Yeshiva. He put out an entire Haggadah. It came out Erev Pesach last year. Every page is also a gem. Every page is a gem. So he goes and analyzes the wicked son. He says the Taina of the Ben Harasha is similar to the irreligious, to those that we find now. The irreligious now, there's not the same hatred as it once was. He says, Ani dati belev. You speak to people, I'm dati here. He says, Ani dati belev. Right? Why are you bothering me with this stuff? Does God really care about these things? So he says, that's what we say, Ilu haya sham. V'lo haya mizet dam pesach al dlasas veso. Meaning, if he was there, he would have been in trouble. He never would have put the sign by the doorpost, because he would have been the guy saying, you think God cares about the details? He's not. It goes back to Prager, by the way. Ironically, it goes back to Prager. The Shaul Alter and Dennis Prager saying the same thing. That's Emunah. Emunah is practice, enable. It's enacted a love. And therefore, who bochen lo malan asot? Why do we need to do an action? God knows our heart. That's evil. If he was there, he wouldn't. It's a great shot. We always say it every year. If the Russia was there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. Why not? You're going to leave the kid behind? It's not saying that. It's saying he's not taking hold of the mechanism that gets us from one generation to the next. He's not holding on to the branch. He wouldn't have put the stuff on the doorpost. He would have said, God knows, it's fine, leave it alone. He doesn't care about these things. And therefore, that's would have been the problem. It's not about leaving him behind. It's he's excluding himself from the very thing that God's telling you, I'm giving you. It's like the mashal with the boat keeps going higher. I sent you a boat each time. I sent you a helicopter. You didn't take the way out. You didn't take the way out. Another great Haggadah, Rav Schechter Haggadah, came out a couple of years ago. Rav Schechter's Haggadah, they put out now four volumes of Rav Schechter's books in English, Rav Schechter's Shirim in English. Why I love it really is his voice. The guy translated, when you write a book, you don't write literal to the person's voice. The style of the book is different than the voice. Rav Schechter's Haggadah is mamish Rav Schechter. When I'm reading it, I'm like, this sounds like Rav Schechter talking. So page 90 and 91, he says here like this, Avadim ha'inu l'paro b'mitzrayim. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt. So the pasuk that describes Moshe's first prophecy, Vayar Malach Hashem Elav Balabos Eish, the angel of God appeared to him from the fire, amid the bush, Mitoch Asneh, Behineh Asneh Boer Ba'esh, and the Sneh was consumed by fire, Ba'asneh Inenu Ukal, but the bush was not consumed. Madua Lo Yivar Asneh, he wondered why it doesn't get consumed. So Rav Soloveitchik suggested, remember Schechter is the star Talmud of Soloveitchik. He says the fire was located only Balabosesh, the lathe, in the midst of the bush. Meaning the bush on the outside appeared the same as any other bush, because it was only Balabosesh in the middle. On the outside, it's the same exact bush as every other bush. And that's why no one saw it except for Moshe. Moshe wondered why the fire did not spread outward from the middle. That was his question. What's that symbolism? That's different than the traditional one. We always make famous the image of the Jewish resilience. But this is different. This is something about the middle on fire not spreading to the outside. What's that? So the Midrashim explained that Moshe doubted the Jewish people earned God's intervention. That because Moshe viewed the people superficially, he didn't see them as worthy. They're just like everybody. They're a bush like everybody else. These people, what do I got to be busy with these people? I was with them in Egypt. They're slaves. They're small-minded. They're petty. Therefore, Hashem says, Re'ei re'iti es ani ami asher b'mitzrayim. Yes, I've seen the affliction of my people in Egypt. And he shows him the burning bush. These are a people who, when they're on fire, that's when they emerge. That's exactly who they are. Which is what the Biyana Rebbe said. I quoted Shabbos. What Moshe says, the Midrash says, Moshe didn't understand how these astronomical calculations work with the new moon. What does he not understand? Moshe was able to understand a lot. It's astronomy that was the hard one? So the answer is, it wasn't the numbers. What bothered him was, how do a people who represent the moon, represents Jewish people, a first mitzvah, so small? How do we survive? We're so little. There's no resources. There's nothing. The answer is, that's exactly how we survive. Right? I chose you for that. It's the miracle of our people. And therefore, we're not supposed to stand in front of the sun. That's not our role. Our role is when we are that small, we seem to have that last breath, that the moon renews itself into a full moon. And that's what he says, the Avadim Hayinu. Oh, Hatayda Avadim Hayinu. This is so good. This is great. This is the payoff from him. So Rav Soloveitchik said, that's why we say Avadim Hayinu Leparo B'Mitzrayim, and not Avde Paro Hayinu. Meaning in the Torah, it says, Paro's advisors, it calls them Avde Paro Hayinu. What's the difference? Avadim Hayinu Leparo B'Mitzrayim is just a outward social political sense. It's what we do for a living, right? There's what you do, and there's who you are. And Avde Paro Hayinu is a description of their essence, the servants of Paro, the Egyptians. The Jews is Avadim Hayinu. What do you do for a living? All right, I also do this on the side, but what I really am is a Jew. Ivri Anochi. That's what I really am. That's a beautiful word from Rav Schechter quoting Rav Soloveitchik. I pulled out a random. I did a random pull on a sefer, and this is, they put out, Rabbi Charlap was the star student of Rav Kook. Rabbi Charlap drank every word that Rav Kook said, and they put out a collection of his poems, just little notes he wrote to himself. It's a beautiful sefer. And I the random page I went to was the following, and I thought you could use it at the Seder when we talk about the Chomer and the Levanim, the bricks and the mortar, the Chomer. Says Rav Charlap, Chayavim anu le'ezor chayel, le'orer kochosenu mochenu. We have to gird ourselves to awaken our strength. Lahazriach aleinu et or nishpatenu, latus bishmei meromim. Meaning, you want to soar in the sky, you want to fly, you want a deep experience, you're going to have to put in the work, you're going to have to pull it together. La'uf al karne or chemdas kedushasenu. You're going to have to fly, but you're also going to have to lirkov al chamor, ride on a donkey. Says in Zechariah 29, it's chapter 9, Ani verochev al chamor, that the Mashiach is going to be described as impoverished and riding on a donkey. Lasim lemirmas kol hachamrius. What does it mean? If the Mashiach is so high and so lofty from another world, it's the holiest thing you could imagine, the holiest embodiment of a human being. What's he doing on a donkey? Says Rav Charlap, the image of Rochev al Chamor is unsaddling your physicality. Chomer is Chamariut, the physical. Umitoch shnei rechuvim al Chamor, gam Chamor yizdakech vitale. And by unloading it, even the Chamor sees this, and the Chamor wants to elevate. Umish yachol lirchov al Chamor, and someone who knows how to really ride a Chamor, hu haMashiach Hamiti. That's the Mashiach. It's a loaded, if you know Rav Charlap, it's a loaded statement. He's not writing Stam after a Purim Sudi, he was just doodling here. It's a deep line. Somebody who knows to really ride a donkey, only that person could be a Mashiach. What he's saying is the Mashiach's not going to be the person who is removed. The Mashiach's going to be the person who could help unload. And that's what the Mashiach's, anybody else will not be the Mashiach. That is the very essence of the Mashiach itself. I think the night that talks about Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, I think the night talks about the Chomer Levanim, you're so far. The two ends of the Seder are so far. When you're a Mitzrayim, you're nothing. We're garbage in Egypt. Right? Whether you take the image of 49th level of Tumah, the Terach plan, or you go the Egypt plan, the physical. Think about it. How spiritual. I always say the three, the hit your head three times test. Drop your pen three times, hit your head each time as you get up. How do you feel by the end of it? Right? You want to go nuts. Right? You're so disrupted. Now imagine that dysregulation of being a slave all those years in Egypt. The dysregulation was immense. These people had no shaychus to kedusha, to sanctity. It wasn't even a possibility. It wasn't a remote possibility. It's easier now when you have air conditioning and leather bound svarim. There's an access that might be easier, but the Rav Chalap is saying that's. But however, you have to be able to rochev al chamor. That's a different avoda to be able to within that to be able to help people help the donkey those who are low, help them to elevate and see greatness. That's a different madrega. And it applies to, I think, everybody. We're in a generation that ikvus of the Mashiach means the heel of the Mashiach. It's the lowest it gets right now. Every time they send out a list of all the Jews' Nobel Prizes, I want to send a list of all the Jews who are mushkas companies and books and things they wrote. And I could send you an equal list the other way. The ikvus of the Mashiach, because that's the end. It's going to be great and it's going to be terrible. It's going to be awesome and it's going to be horrific. That's this generation. And you have to be able to lirchav achamor to elevate us. Rav Bechofer is a big Talmud Chacham out in Muncie. He taught in MTA High School, and he does these podcasts online. And sometimes his transcript is up. I love looking at it because always outside of the box ideas. Rav Bechofer says, "What's the pshat in v'hi she'amda? That which stood for us. What stood for us? Shelo echad. Not one. What do you mean, not one? So you have a king upset." At his son. And he did some punishment to the king. You film whatever you want for any classic story. So banished him from the kingdom, made him schlep a boulder, whatever you want to put there. The king had regrets about the decree, but he couldn't rescind it. That was the law. So an advisor said to grind up, here, we'll do this one, the stone that he's making him carry everywhere. Grind up the stone and give it back to the son as pebbles and dust. Meaning, it's nothing. The guy's going to be holding nothing in his hand. There's nothing to hold anymore. The rock's basically gone. You've ground it up. There's nothing there anymore. So due to sin eschinim, we're deserving of a more devastating punishment. The hatred, how terrible we've been to each other. Instead, Hashem spread the punishment over multiple generations. He didn't give us one. He spread it out. So what's Hishemda? Shelo Echad. Meaning God did not make the punishment one. Shelo Echad. I'm not going to make it just one. I'm gonna distribute it, so that we can able to handle it and keep going through and make our way through. Fascinating diuk in the words. I want to show you one thing you could do here. So, how do you use, like I said, AI to augment your Seder on some level? So, one way to do it is to convene the Grand Pesach conversation. I'll do that soon. I want to do another one. I created a bot. I'm working on a bot that's the biggest lamdan in the world. I want to put in it all the greatest mental frameworks, everything. It's a work in progress. We're almost there. I want to test it. I gave it a test run today. I want to take a famous Pesach question on my bot and ask it, see if it could answer it. Okay, it's one of those, difficult ones, not a simple one. I don't want it to be one that just searches the internet and gives you an answer. It's just when you can't. So, it's my bot is called Reb Leibish Maibis. I picked the name of someone who doesn't exist because I don't want it to be confused and pull from that person either. And the method he's using is called the Volter Broad method. I made that up too because I don't want it to pull from a method that exists as well. Now, I wrote, use the Volter Broad method to solve this problem in the Pesach Haggadah. The Haggadah says, Reb Elazar ben Azaria said, behold, I'm like a 70-year-old person. V'lo zachiti, and I didn't merit to have the law follow my view that the Exodus is to be mentioned at night, meaning in Shema every evening during the year. Ad shedarsha ben Zoma, until ben Zoma came along and gave us a proof text. I asked Rav Leibish Maibis, why did Rav Elazar ben Azaria have this view prior to ben Zoma? Meaning, if he had a proof text, then he had a proof text. If he didn't have a proof text, why did he think that was the halacha? Mimanu shach. If you have no source, then you wouldn't have thought it's the halacha. He thought it's the halacha, but had no source. Why'd you think it was? It's a hard question. There's a few who answer. So I asked Rav Leibish Maivis. Here we go. He says, we must delve into the intricate layers of Talmudic logic and the unique principles of the Volterbrod method. Number one, his statement, I am like a 70-year-old person, the statement prior to the proof text, seems puzzling. Why would he say that? This is where the integration of classical logic and modal logic into it becomes crucial. Rabbi Elizabeth Azaria's stance can be understood as a logical derivation from existing principles. I don't know what he's talking about now. I'm on the same page as you. No clue what he's saying. But he's going. And by the way, the way it works, it rants for a while. And then by the end, you're like, oh my gosh, we're all finished. We're toast. Okay, here it goes. This is his answer. He says the following.
This is AI.
This is Rav Leibish Maivis AI. Okay? He says like this. Oh, I love it. Yeah. So, Bahagadat al-Abincha, you shall teach your son, obligates to engage with each of the children. Each of them have their own approach to this question. So he gives an answer from the vantage point of each one, which is amazing because Rabbi Alan Schwartz last year put out the Four Sons Haggadah, which is the Haggadah is meant to be read from the view of each of the four sons. By the way, he translates the child of each one different than we have it. He follows the Yerushalmi a bit, but we'll leave that alone for now. So he says like this, he says, you know what was happening? This was the time when Rabbi Gamliel still had authority and was not allowing anybody's view to hold the day. If you know what happened in the Gemara, this was the time over the struggle over who would lead the academy. Rabbi Gamliel would not allow anybody who was less than the elite into the Beis Medrash. They had to wait outside. They had no act. He didn't want to hear from the common person. Rabbi Gamliel said no. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria had a source. He had ideas. He had original thoughts. I'm like a 70-year-old guy. I should get some status. Rabbi Gamliel said, I'm not allowing anybody to change anything in here. Until Ben Zoma, who carried weight, where Rabbi Gamliel already had to shake, and then the political pressure ensued and toppled him, at that moment he said, "Now he said, I didn't have zchus. We didn't have this zchus. Zchus is not something you say when I figured out an argument. Zchus is something you say, I have the privilege of a position." Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria became the head of the yeshiva, and Rabbi Gamliel was thrown out. He had to beg for forgiveness, then they split the time. But you understand this? What a great chiddush this is. This is an incredible answer. It works. And he says the socio-political answer may not work for all four of the children. It takes a certain type of child who will think in terms of these methodologies. Okay? That's the Volterbrod method's answer to this problem. Okay? I think it's... I don't know. Ben Zoma says... Ben Zoma's position is that you should say the Exodus at night in Shema every night. But he said, I didn't merit to say it at night. What do you mean, didn't merit? He means, I didn't have halakha follow me. It didn't go my way until Ben Zoma. What did you have until Ben Zoma? Meaning he felt this, but he needed Ben Zoma to say it. He needed someone like Ben Zoma to get up and say it, and he needed the time to be right for Gamliel's leadership to fall inward, and they deposed him, and they got him out. So I think that's unique. I also think it's a beautiful time to the Seder. Rabbi Daniel Gladstein has this in his Haggadah. He says that's the beauty of the four children of the Seder. You want them all to express their opinion. You want to hear what they have to say. We're not stifling anybody by any stretch of the imagination. The Seder is not a time to stifle opinions. Rabbi Gamliel did stifle, and it didn't last. It was taken down. He stifled. And the answer, and Rabbi Elizabeth Azaria's way was the one that won. Did not. We didn't reject Rabbi Gamliel. He came back in. You're going to need those tough ones. You're going to need those elitists. But they don't run the show. You have them around, but they don't run the show. It's like he's coming back. Reminds me also, right? When you break the yachatz, the matzah, so the Sat Merov says in his Agada, you get rid of the half because you can't tell a Seder story, a holy story with a bunch of apikorsim sitting around the table. So you got to get rid of the half, put it away. One of my students, I told in New York, this Dar Torah, he answered, you don't throw it away. He said, you save it for the best part of the Seder. You bring it for the afikomen. Those that have been rejected, those that have been cast aside. We do want them there, which goes against the traditional understanding of if he would have been in Mitzrayim, he wouldn't have been saved. It's not chastising him. You want him there. You're saying you're not holding on to the thing that God gave you a gift, and you're You're missing out. Okay. Give myself a headache. All right, where are we here? Now, so let's continue. Let's continue. There's so many. So we had, last week, we lost one of the great intellectual powerhouses of psychology was Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman wrote the book Think Fast, Think Slow. He wrote that in response to Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, which Malcolm Gladwell felt that you know, most things you could figure out spontaneously. There's that guy Gottman who could figure out whether a relationship's going to last in 4.7 seconds, whatever the time was. Things happen instinctively. And Kahneman argued vehemently. He said, no, there's a balance and there's a bias that's happening. And the contributions of Kahneman were great ones. He came up with the idea of heuristics and bias. That there are several, by the way, he is Rav Kahneman of the Ponovitcher Rebbe's nephew. The famous Rav Kahneman of Ponovitcher Rebbe, he's his nephew. So he identified there are several cognitive shortcuts that lead to errors, biases, and judgments. That's why snap judgments are not good. You have biases and don't realize they're there. And therefore, relying too heavily on an initial piece of information called an anchor, you have to be very careful. Two, prospect theory. What is that? How people make choices under risk. It's called loss aversion. For example, they feel the pain of loss much more intensely than pleasure, and therefore they'll make a decision based on that, and a bad decision based on that. Three, dual process theory. This is where he wrote the book. The mind operates quickly, automatic, intuitive, but also slow, deliberate, logical. Havim asunim bedin. It does both. And then there's hedonic psychology. Focused on, at the end of his life, he focused on happiness and well-being. What promotes happiness? There's certain experiences that bias everything. I mentioned in Shul, I call it the usual suspects effect. The end of the movie was so good, no one remembers any other part of it. It might have been good, it might not, but it was so good, that's all your mind is just focused on. Nostalgia also, you remember one thing that happened, and it clouds everything else. So I thought these Kahneman ideas, which I are very intuitive to Judaism, are very much educational pieces at the Seder. For example, you are anchoring on the maror. God wants us to anchor into the bitter. Why are you doing that? You're out. Because you have to remember, you have to recall, you have to, because you're going to forget. Us Jews are going to forget. So you have to root yourself in that anchor, which is why you're palpably tasting that maror. And based on that, you adjust. Now make your kiddush. Now with that in mind, make your kiddush. Prospect theory. The idea being a loss aversion, that you're going to avoid this, you're going to avoid that. The Jews didn't want to cross the water. Listen, we don't want to die. We've been through enough already. We're not going to cross here. They would have stayed with that calculation. They would have been finished. It's a faulty calculation. Because that was no good, this is going to be no good. That's not equivalent. Your equation's off. Because God took you out, He will deliver you. That's the equation you need to have. And there's dual process theory. Fast and slow. There's chipazon. We're getting out, making the matzah. You got to get out. You got to go quick. You spend the whole night talking about the Exodus. Kol hamar belasaper harizim mishubach. Take shlep. Take the Seder as long as you need. Keep going. Tell the whole night Mitzrayim. Keep going. And then finally, the hedonic psychology. We're sitting there eating the mortar that's maybe babies. I don't know. The blood that's wine. And we're singing v'samarta and eating chicken matzo ball soup. Only our people over there. So that's hedonic psychology. That there's both elements that happiness plays such an incredible role and what you choose to focus on. And the ability, our success, is the ability to successfully jump from one to the other and do it well. There's a great magazine, the Mizrahi magazine that comes out. The one that came out last year on Pesach time, I was reading all the articles, and I say one stood out for me as just really something special. And that was, he always, a great thinker, he's controversial, has always great ideas. His name is Rav Yuval Shurlo. Really a great mind. Rosh Hashiva in Israel, one of the leading thinkers in Israel. And he says, of all the symbols on Seder night, the most difficult to understand is the charoset. Very unusual. Because we're commanded to give the reasons for the mitzvah. One who doesn't explain why a Pesach matzah maror, he's not fulfilled his obligation. Okay? So therefore what? Not only that, but halacha determines the official explanation. Halacha gives you the reason for everything. It tells you why. For this one, the charoset stands out. We don't know the source. It doesn't explicitly appear in the Torah. It's not even clear why we eat it. In the Mishnah, there's a machlokas tanayim. One opinion holds charoset isn't mandatory. Rav Elazar Brav Tzadok says it is. There's a debate in the Torah whether we have to eat the charoset. You see, it's part of the confusion around charoset. So because of that debate, there's two explanations. First opinion, charoset is part of the gastronomic directives, the food directives, to soften the sharpness of the maror. But according to Rav Lozer, it's not just an accessory. It's something itself. What is it? This I don't know. Okay, so the Gemara and the Medrash offer explanations. One is the texture. Remind us of the mud. This is all Pasha stuff. The second is the ingredients. The apple reminds the apple trees where the women comforted their husbands after a rough and tough day at work. But the fact that charoset doesn't carry an official explanation opens the door for so much creativity. So when we examine the range of theories, we find a widespread theme dealing with the charoset sweetness and the bitterness of the maror. In fact, the juxtaposition of the sweetness and bitterness is already in the seven species, oil and honey. And this is rough, this is his idea now, Rav Shlomo. I loved it. We're always used to thinking that Judaism has moments of reflection on darkness, moments of reflections on light. Tisha B'Av is darkness, and Purim is light. You have different moments. You have darkness in our history. You have lights in our history. Says Rav Shlomo. Many of his suffered tremendous losses. Many of his Talmidim in Israel. He says that one of the ways to characterize our bond with our history and with Hashem, who manages that history, is the transition between bitterness and sweetness. It is wrong to simply state that sometimes we had good times and sometimes we had bad. Seder night says you eat both. Why? They are the same event. The bitterness and the sweetness occur at one and the same time. The period itself was terrible. We eat maror. And so we also give thanks by dipping the maror in the charoset because we're here. We're still around. Israel acknowledges Yom HaZikaron. Tremendous sadness over the losses in Israel. He says it bleeds into the Yom HaTzmaut. You can't be a human being to have suddenly forgot what happened before. It's not a world of contrasts. It's a world where the maror and the charoset are together. That's our people. And you think where we go to the future of October 7th. There's no version of it where at the end of it becomes a Simchas Torah like it was before. But now it becomes one that is more equivalent to this image that Rav Shirlo is portraying as the Jewish experience. It's not sometimes blood, sometimes water, but rather it's the mixture of the elements together, which sort of epitomize and represent our people and what they struggle with. So that is that idea. What time are we holding by? Oh, it's getting late already. It's getting late. Okay, we're going to bring it to a close. Wow, that went fast.
You shouldn't have had me open.
Nah, that opened the evening. That gave us the time to talk about these things. At Pesachlo.
So what do we take from that mixture?
It's not a religion that has contrasting experiences. It's that Judaism experience is living with the context of both together. That everything is Gamzu L'Tova, and also at the same time it is bad. It's a mess. And this is our people. This is the state of Israel. There's no way to look at it else to look at it. It's the most beautiful gift in the world. It's exceptionally complicated. It's a mess.
Why is that not a contrast?
Contrast is I think that it is contrast. It's a blended. It's in it together. The mitzvah is it together. The representation of the mitzvah are the two together. You understand? They exist. They coexist. It's coexistence with the contradiction and the contrast. That's the key. I will show you one more AI thing. Tumor Divrei Torah. We call it a night. We go with another few more years of this. Now,
another.
No. I don't do. This is for before and after. Eliyahu runs the show. I don't say a word at the say to the kids.
I'm serious.
I don't know what time. My father's minhag is we're over before it begins. What time is it over? 22 minutes. I'm serious. I'm sitting there looking around. Everyone's gone. I'm sitting. Everybody's over.
You should do like a 5 hour for
a
community.
Community seder. Oh, community seder. No. My father would kill me. Yeah, definitely.
I would love.
I could talk all night. Yeah. Fine. So, this is where I think is a great usage of AI. You may hate this, but do what you want with it. You can now convene roundtables that you never could have before. So, I go, here we go. This is we're going to have fun at the Seder. Okay, this one over here. This is a terrible browser. Imagine you're convening a grand... This is the prompt I put. You can put it in GPT, whatever you want. Imagine you're convening a grand conversation for Lifetime Channel or something similar about the Pesach Seder and the Haggadah. It's a lengthy show that is an awesome conversation between some of the world's greatest thinkers. They have insight and thoughts on the Haggadah and on Passover and all of its motifs. Here are the round table participants. You can put whoever you want. You can't put somebody too remote that GPT-4 does not know yet. Mirtz Hashem, by GPT-6, they're going to know Reb Chaim Brisker's seventh son's cousin's roommate, okay? Now, one, I put in there Brené Brown. Two, Slavoj Zizek, one of the, he's the biggest philosopher right now. He's off his mind. Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. Anyone know who that is? Look it up. Five, legendary philosopher David Hume. Number six, Fichtner Hahn. Einhorn's lost it. And number seven, Tony Robbins. They're sitting together. This is an evening. I go, let's go. Let's see what happens here. So the show begins. Thank you for inviting us. Thank you. Yeah, it's going back and forth here like it's a real show. Okay, fine. Are we live? We're live. The director, whoever it is, broke up the show into four rounds. Okay, into four rounds. The first round is to ask the participants questions about, what is it, UI or UX, when you can't see where the thing is, the UX, right? UX interface? It's terrible. So the head of the show, round four, is Haggadah in the modern world. Okay, round one, the meaning of freedom. Okay, the meaning of freedom. That was the first round. So let's see what they discussed on the meaning of freedom. By the way, what is this? Is this nuts? What is this? I'll tell you what is this doing, and that's how you explain it. This is really what it is. It's throwing just ideas up there. It's kicking up stuff based on frameworks that these people talk in. And hopefully when you sit with it, you'll come up with ideas. Rabbi, are you allowed to do that? What do you think every mushal with the king and the kopek is? The king and the poritz and the kopek. Those were the contextual stories that Jews had back then from which to generate and come up with ideas. That's how they came up. You shake your context and you go to thinking of ideas. So let's go to round one. And I'm telling you, there's 50 Haggadahs just in this opening episode. Because episode two already has, I don't know, we'll put the Chuck Norris, we'll figure it out. Now, so we have, here it is, where did I put it? Number one? Yeah. Okay, host introduction. Welcome to our roundtable discussion of the meaning of freedom. Center Pesach Seder and Haggadah. Let's explore the profound subject. Our distinguished guest, Brené. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Freedom to me involves the courage to be vulnerable. At the Seder, we talk about our weak points as well. Our forefather was an idolater in Egypt. Why are we airing our laundry in public? Because to share who you are means to share where you've been. That's the Koshnitzer Magid said that, not Brené Brown. It really is a Koshnitzer Magid. I've always said that. But so wait, that's Brené Brown's idea, that vulnerability is the essence of who you are. Zizek. Zizek is, his ideas are that words, we get trapped in the words. And you get yourself stuck in something that doesn't mean anything because you put too much weight on the word. Freedom? What kind of question is this? We've not even defined the word properly. It's a paradox. Consider Exodus. We're told we're going to have freedom, and then we're not going to be shackled by pharaohs. But all of a sudden, wait a second, we're now going to be shackled by a worse thing, our desires. That's not freedom. True freedom is not the absence of the chain. True freedom is to be done with the bondage that has held you back from that which you were trying to achieve. That's a gewaldic idea, because ein cheres, there's no freedom except that which is charis aleluchos, that which is engraved on the tablets. We become slaves to God. Isn't that, someone's going to ask, are we slaves again? It's not freedom is not chaos. That's the book, right? The kids on the Lord of the Rings. I think Riverdance. Okay, next. Now, then Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Freedom is both a gift and a responsibility. But what is freedom? Freedom is the fact that now, here, after all these generations, our children are still asking questions. The children, the youth, are still asking questions. I don't know, Rabbi. I have to look this up. Rabbi Sacks said this anyway. It's him. Sounds like him. And it goes to what we talked about before. It's great. And he was smart. He didn't ask everybody in the panel in the first round. That's not how a good interviewer goes. I'll just give you one more round. And that was, after it was over, the show was over, I just couldn't get enough. I went back and I said, okay, please, the inclusion of the four children in the Haggadah serves as a... Here, what would each of them say is the purpose of why the Haggadah did that? Why is that there? Okay. Says Zizek, the four children represent the varied ways the individuals relate to ideology and authority. The wise child is compliance. He's compliance. This is Reb Shlomo Carbach. Reb Shlomo Carbach says, I don't know if your chacham is your big tzaddik. He's just going along with everything. It was a chiddush Reb Shlomo Carbach. He's going there too. The wicked represents rebellious, critique, challenging the status quo. The simple child, hold on, the simple child, is accepts the narrative at face value and has nothing more to add to the conversation. And the one who cannot ask has been so blinded by these terrible definitions that he forgets there's even a question to ask. He goes, the tableau of children sitting here reflect the different ways we engage with politics and culture. And sometimes you need a little bit of each of those. That's, you know who says that? That's Rabbi Riskin's word on the Haggadah. Riskin says you bring all four sons to the Haggadah because we're all of those. Those are all the people of who we are. This is, I mean, I'll stop with those, but I want to finish with one that's, I guess, authentic. I don't know why that's not authentic. But that to me, it's a great Torah. It's great Torah to me, and I love it. I'll give you one more, and we close the night with it. I fed it with no Haggadahs. What Haggadahs? They didn't write Haggadahs. Dichna Handan right now, Haggadah. And Plum Island. They did last year, they had Haggadahs, right when everybody got access to GPTs. They had Haggadah. You look at it now. If you can get a copy of it, it's the scariest thing. I'll tell you why. It's garbage. If you see where they've gone in just a year, from that to this, you know what that means for in a year from now. Again, we're finished. Now let's go. Here we go. So let's close with the Tolner Rebbe Haggadah. You heard it here first. The Tolner Rebbe Haggadah, this one is, people were fighting. They said people, the guy told me, beagleizing. People were fighting to get it, the Tolner Haggadah. There was a brawl that broke out over the Tolner Haggadah. So he said, what's the opposite of a chacham? The opposite of a wise should be a tipesh, the fool, right? Not the Rasha. Instead, who's the pair that's paired up with the chacham? It's a famous Ratzah, right? You've heard that question. The Rasha, the wicked. That's not parallel, right? It's a famous question. Since Tolner Rebbe says, what you see from here, the wickedness is not a function of being someone terrible, necessarily. Wickedness can be a function of stupidity. It's acting like a moron in that moment. That's what you see from the parallel. The rishus comes from a foolish way at looking at the world, no matter how brilliant you are. That's the difference. Einstein said to himself, how many years of good study of great inventions, right? How many good years of good study of great inventions would I get? He asked himself, I would never have traded up all these nights for my friends who went out and on the town and did this. He goes, that's the brilliance. That was the brilliance, says the Tolner Rebbe. The brilliance was also, yes, the invention. But the brilliance was that he intellectualized the idea that my worth is more deployed here than something which is fleeting. Sometimes the rishus is not necessarily what we call wicked. It's bad behavior as a result of stupidity. That's the opposite of the chacham. That's the rishus, that you caused something, that you were so dumb in what you did. That's the rishus. And I always look at it this way, that you have one of the greatest geniuses in history, Stephen Hawking, who said, we've come to a point where the world is so well designed. We've absconded ourselves of the need of God in that schema. And the great futurist and scientist, contemporary scientist, Michio Kaku, got up, a great book, and he wrote, he just got it wrong by one phrase. The world is so beautiful, perfectly designed, that everything acts and follows one after the other in such a way that we couldn't comprehend, and therefore it needs the God. And therefore, because of that, it had to have been a God. Meaning the line between the brilliant conclusion of a brilliant mind once in a generation is so close from what our vantage point is. Tipshus is it's the foolish conclusion. It's the wrong direction. And that, says the Tolner Rebbe, is the difference between the Chacham and the Rasha. It's not an evil. It's a foolishness to see things the way they ought to be seen. Everybody should have a beautiful and meaningful Seder. And any new insights that you see, you want to share, please send them my way. We much appreciate it. Shkoyach, everybody.